It's time to introduce the speaker, right? Well, I don't have to introduce him. Everybody knows him, eh? Anyway, okay, so Double Doctor and his partner, Liz James, and Eric back there, a cameraman. Gary began his medical career in Zaire after completing medical school training at the University of Saskatchewan and receiving a diploma in tropical medicine and hygiene in Antwerp, Belgium. Upon returning to Canada, he completed his general surgery residency training at the University of Saskatchewan before going to Winnipeg, where he completed a fellowship in general surgical oncology. And I looked it up. Cancer treatment, okay, just in case I'm not the only one who doesn't know what it is. When he returned to Saskatoon in 1992, Dr. Groot established himself as a general surgery oncologist with a special interest in head and neck oncology. From 1999 to 2005, Gary was the head of surgery for the Saskatoon Health Region, and in 2011, he completed a PhD, and that's why I've always referred to him as Double Doctor. Double Doc, yeah. And after that, he became actively involved with clinical quality improvement work and research. So all I can say at this point is, wow, I'm glad you found time to come and speak to us, Gary.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting Liz and I to come back and address you this morning. I don't know how you managed to get this nice weather. That was very nice. For a substitute, that's pretty good. I hope you're in a mood for some stories, because that's what I intend to do today. And the stories I'm going to share with you are actually a part of my journey, but they're kind of a journey over almost 40 years now. Keep that in mind. But more importantly, the real story isn't about me. The real story, really, for me, it's about, or what I'm hoping to provoke in you, or to plant a little seed, is to think about each of our own personal ministries and how it can, and in my case, did change and grow as we grow. So I encourage you to do the thing you're not supposed to do and let your mind wander. If you're not listening to the words I say, that's okay. But I want you to let your mind wander, and I want you to overlay your story on top of mine. Because I think it's in telling our stories that we find the strength and courage to live our lives with the belief that each of us has a mission to fulfill. A ministry to live, and that is best realized within the confines of a loving, supporting community. Now, before I begin, I have a question for you. How many of you have ever been camping? Almost everybody. Just when you're about to fall asleep, you're sitting in the tent or in your cabin, and you hear this pesky, annoying little sound. You know what I'm talking about? There, you know there's a mosquito out there somewhere. He's just waiting to get you. You have no idea where that pest is. And I don't know about you, but usually I'm already in enough of a sleepy fog. That little pest seems to know that wait until you're just about asleep, right? And I'm just in that sleepy fog enough that at some point I strike out and I try and slap the thing. And of course I miss every time because I don't know where it is. And I do that usually three or four times before I either give up and let her bite and get it over with, or I wake up, turn on a flashlight, find the darn thing, and get rid of it. Recently, I was sitting in a room with a man that I was just meeting, and his name is Gilbert. He's an Aboriginal elder that works with the Saskatoon Health Region. And it was suggested that I should meet with Gilbert to discuss a research project that I was trying to get off the ground that has to do with improving the way we as healthcare professionals might do a better job of helping our Aboriginal patients make complex healthcare decisions, specifically around cancer. Gilbert was quiet and unassuming, kind and gentle. We talked about health, and culture. We talked about residential schools and Native spirituality and Native medicine. And without actually using the words, we talked about the difference between a Western worldview of medicine, medicine chest, if you will, and an Aboriginal worldview, medicine wheel. The journey to meeting with Gilbert had been a long and convoluted one. As was mentioned previously, I'm a cancer surgeon in Saskatoon, and I had decided to go back to school in my late 40s. And I went back to school mostly because I was getting a little bored, and I was looking for taking on a new challenge and incorporating some research into my life. And when I finished my PhD in 2011, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to do with that. I just did it for the fun of it. Until Liz became my metaphorical mosquito. You see, Liz was taking classes at Meadville Seminary in Chicago, where they're obsessed with issues of privilege, given the race issues south of the border. And she was also doing all sorts of cultural competency stuff with the Unitarian Ministers Association here in Canada. And she was becoming really testy. Testy about our privilege and wanting to push us, which meant me, to do something about our, which meant the settlers, relationship with the Aboriginal community. And this conversation happened over a couple of years. Her pushing, me pushing back, or if you listen to Liz, it might be the other way around. I have a need to justify my pushing back, and to do that, I have to go back a few years. So bear with me. As you were already told, I started my medical career in Africa, what was then Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo. I was 24, energetic, idealistic, and I thought I was going to spend the rest of my career over there. The 2 years that I did spend there were very formative for me. I loved the work. I loved the place that I was living. Most of all, I loved the people. I learned so much from that experience and from the Zairean people, learnings that continue to this day. And I want to tell you a story about that time, about a very close friend of mine. His name was Chamoa. Chamoa was my neighbor the second year that I lived there. He was a roly-poly kind of fellow, which made him stand out amongst the rest of the Zairians, who tended to be a little gaunt at best. He was an easygoing, happy guy. Almost always had a smile on his face and tended to be a very optimistic individual. Jolly almost. He was a theologian. He was trained in the United States, and so he spoke English, and that kind of made him stand out as well. But underneath that jolly exterior, Chamoa was a very deep and thoughtful person with a lot of insight. He was kind and gentle. The biblical concept of shepherd would probably be appropriate. One morning I was getting ready for breakfast, and Chamoa knocked on my door. He explained to me that his niece had given birth the night before at one of the clinics in the city. And you have to understand that a clinic in the city that I was living in, it was about the size of Regina, just meant a place that someone who may or may not have had any formal training had set up, not associated in any official way with the hospital, and with no quality oversight at all. He was wondering if I might be able to stop by on my way to work to visit his niece. She had delivered the night before. I asked if it was urgent, and he said, "Oh, no, just come when you can, my friend." So I went to go finish my breakfast, but I couldn't help but notice that he just stood there in the doorway and that there was a truck outside that was running. Now, you have to understand, in Zaire, that renting that truck, because nobody owned vehicles, would have cost him a month's salary. Leaving a vehicle running was just unheard of. So even though I was still getting ready for the day, I was able to put two and two together and figured this was probably more important than he was letting on. So I grabbed my fishing, I had a big fishing tackle box that I had put together for emergencies. You have to remember, I was one of two doctors in the city the size of Saskatoon, or Regina. And so I'd gotten used to the fact that people came to my door all the time for emergencies. So I had my little emergency box for these sorts of things. I grabbed my motorbike, my emergency box, and followed him off to the clinic. And when I arrived, his niece was lying on the ground, bleeding heavily. Here in Canada, it would be almost unheard of for a woman to die of a postpartum hemorrhage. In Zaire, it was unfortunately quite common and quite a tragic event. And it's tragic because it's so easily treated. A little uterine massage to make the uterus contract, a drug called Pitresin in addition to some IV fluids and or blood as needed. So I started in on the resuscitation. I immediately began with uterine massage. And you have to understand that for massage to work, forgive me for being graphic, you have to use both hands, one on the abdomen and the other one inside the vagina so that you can really massage that uterus. But she was in shock, having bled through the night. She also needed an IV, and she needed somebody to give her the drugs. So you can imagine my dilemma, sitting there massaging her uterus with both hands, but also needing to do these other things. A dilemma that only got worse when her heart stopped beating. I had a large, solid needle in my emergency bag that I used to start an intravenous in a little vein that's always under your collarbone. And I started giving her fluids. My wife, who had no medical background at all, I told her, hold this needle, don't let it move, because it didn't have any catheter covering like ours do. It was just a solid needle, so it could easily slash that vein. And while the fluids and the Pitresin were running in, I alternated between doing cardiac massage, breathing for her, massaging the uterus, while Chomoa was taking pictures. And the relatives were wailing in the background, because in their culture, it was traditional to wail when someone died, because if you didn't, that meant that you were the one who'd put the curse on that person to die. Well, after 2 liters of fluid, her heartbeat returned. After 5 liters, I pulled out that IV. We tossed her in the back of the vehicle and ran her over to our hospital, where I told Chomoa he had to give her some blood because we didn't have a blood bank, and we would take blood from one relative to another, or none at all. I'm pleased to say that right now that young lady's doing very well, I've heard recently. And there's a young woman walking around the city of Chakapa with the name of Gili. They can't say Ars in their language, so it's Gili. It was easily 2 months before Chomoa would talk to me again. And when he did, it was with a very formal invitation to join him for tea. After a few small moments of talking about the weather and things like that, he looked at me and he said, "My niece was dead, and now she's alive. Only God can do that, so you must be God." So we talked about how resuscitation is a thing we do in the West, about modern medicine more broadly, about humanity and about religion. In the end, he just laughed and said, "You white people, you just don't know when to stop." A few weeks before I was due to leave Zaire, Chomoa invited me over again for tea. This time he had a different thing to say to me. "It doesn't matter how hard you try to be one of us, how simple you choose to live, how well you speak my language, how much time you live amongst us, you will never be one of us." He went on to explain that if I needed a heart transplant, he knew that I would hop on a plane, I would go home, and I would get a heart transplant. And if he needed one, he would die. His words hurt me deeply at the time, because I had sincerely wanted to be a person who lived life with integrity, and it felt to me like he was pointing out my inability to right the big wrongs of the world. And I returned to Canada feeling sad, and a tad disillusioned, to say the least, and feeling deep guilt for my privilege that I did not earn or even ask for. Thank you.
I am nostalgic for the days when it was my fault for being white. Sent home after an operation, she spent days just enduring. The pain started in her abdomen and began to sprawl out, settling in the spaces between her ribs, corralling her breath into tight knots until her voice was windless. She became settled land, pressed against the bed, flat and silent as ironed white sheets. By the time she's brought into the ER, she's been made loud. Clothed in wires and tubes and flashing red and blue lights, they wonder why she waited so long to say something was wrong. They tell her now she is infested with complications. This time, it's a hospital, but it could just as easily be a courtroom or a school. This time, it's medicine that seems to give way underneath her in subtle and devastating ways. And this time, it's my husband who comes home carrying the despair and fury of defeat crouched tensely on the back of his neck. My first thought is how I would have spoken up in her shoes. I would have known that the world shouldn't be as painful as that. I would have called for help, confident in the draw of my own voice. I would not have waited for my bleeding to speak for me. That's what I thought too, my husband answers me. That's what I thought the first time. I begin to realize all the ways in which I have been taught speech in ways that go beyond words. How I've been given a voice inflated with the sound of sirens, how each ritual of medicine fits around my culture like the unnoticeable protection of a surgeon's glove. And I think about how her blood has generations of practice in being told it does not fit, in being seen as a complication of the landscape. An entire generation quarantined, treated, sterilized, clumsily laundered, given new creases, ironed flat into proper rows. Where I have been groomed into assertiveness, she has become practiced in endurance. Even his uniform, he tells me, his scrubs, his suit, his very haircut are all signs of authority, cues to compliance and silence. So I don't pretend anymore to understand the reasons she didn't speak up, or at least didn't speak up in a way that we could hear her. She is mottled with history and culture and calluses, and the camouflage has become so thick that to some eyes she is no more than landscape. In the wee hours of the morning, he's looking over her chart. There are drifts of white paper in which they have meticulously recorded her temperature, her respiratory rate, her blood work. I don't understand how there could be so much information here, and yet so much of her is still left uncharted. Patient history, they call it. They meant something else, something that has nothing to do with understanding our history or with being patient. I am nostalgic for the days when it was my fault for being white. When my mind moved in these choreographed patterns around certain thoughts, and this sandpapering grade of guilt was something that I just lived with, waiting on myself until someday I would step up and do the right thing that I didn't yet understand how to do, and then I could fix the mistakes that are sewn into the color of my skin. Even that phrase, do the right thing, carries with it a kind of comforting lie that the cure to this is somehow held in something as simple as my actions, which can be diagnosed and treated and fixed, and there's this comforting implication that all the power is mine. Even now there are days when my every footstep on this land cringes under the weight of our mutual history, and the cacophony of my own blame and absolution drowns out everything else. It is so much easier to apologize than it is to listen. That one summer, when I was a kid up in Lac La Ronge, I remember the brown-skinned little boy, how he pointed at the bushes, saying, "It's right there! It's right in front of us! How come you can't see it?" And finally, when I insisted he was lying, he tossed a pebble at the rabbit so it would move, and then it appeared. And I was sad later, wondering if he had hurt it just so it would become visible to me. I wished I knew how to fix white eyes back then. As sure as now, I wish I could dilate my mind so I can perceive these subtle things. Complexities that I have mistaken for no more than complications. It is easier to diagnose than it is to learn. It is easier to negotiate than to become part of one another's story. And this is why they insisted so long ago that we smoke a pipe together first. Because just like a person is only a person while their heart is still beating, a treaty is only a treaty within a relationship. So we will not heal this land and its people by starting with the paperwork. It is so much easier to apologize than it is to listen.
I have no idea when Liz wrote that poem. It could have been almost any time since I came back to Canada. You see, it has been a reoccurring awareness, just like that pesky mosquito in the tent, an awareness that somehow we just aren't doing as good a job with our Aboriginal patients as we should be doing. Very early on when I came back to Canada, I recognized similarities between African culture and Aboriginal culture. Both cultures value community and communal ways of being and knowing much more than my European culture. Both cultures value relationship differently, for example. And I made an effort to incorporate an understanding of those differences into my interactions with the Aboriginal community, as I was able to. For example, it's always been my practice to encourage patients to bring family and friends with them to their doctor's visit. With my Aboriginal patients, this often took on a whole different meaning. I remember one patient who needed surgery for colon cancer. He wanted a family meeting with me. It took a few days to get it all organized, and when the time came for the meeting, there was literally in a hospital bed, you can just imagine if you've been in a hospital recently, there was at least 15 family members in there with me and this gentleman. And he introduced me to each member of his family and told me who they were and a little bit about them. And he asked a little bit about me and about my family. And at the end of that, he turned to me and he said, "Okay, you're my surgeon. Go ahead and book the surgery." And I said, "But we haven't talked about the surgery yet." And he said, "I don't know anything about surgery. I know you." When I was in Zaire, we had a rash of neonates, newborns, present to our hospital with tetanus. I'd never seen tetanus in my training, and it took me a while to understand what I was dealing with. And these little kids would arrive in my hospital, and within 24 hours, they would be dead of their disease. I didn't save a single one of them. And that wasn't that I didn't put a lot of effort into it. And at some point, I was lamenting the number of children that were dying of this absolutely, totally preventable disease. And one of my nurses pointed out that most of these kids were coming from a handful of villages a ways away. So we got on my motorbike one day and we drove out there to see if we could figure out what was going on. And it turns out that the women had started putting cow dung on the umbilical cords so they would fall off a little quicker. And the cow dung was the source of the tetanus. We managed to convince them to stop that practice, and the neonatal tetanus epidemic stopped instantly. Sometimes it takes a while to even recognize that there's a problem upstream from the thing that's right in front of you. In this case, that the problem isn't the child with the tetanus who presented to my hospital and for whom I had absolutely no hope of saving, given the resources I had at my disposal. But the practice of putting cow dung on the umbilical cords. And having found the source of the problem, you get it, right? Getting upstream isn't just a different way of thinking. It requires caring in a different way, getting involved, building relationships. It took me a while to understand that there was actually an upstream issue that I was encountering with my Aboriginal patients, who were disproportionately dying of sepsis in our city, presenting with serious complications after surgery, presenting with late-stage cancer, having drug and alcohol addictions, and on and on. Learning to be culturally competent just wasn't enough. One of the required courses for my PhD was a class on health promotion. It was taught by Catherine Green, who's one of our congregants in Saskatoon. Now, Catherine isn't here, so I feel kind of safe confessing that I wasn't sure I was going to get very much out of that class, but I went in with an open mind, and I actually found my world turned upside down. During that class, I was catapulted back to my time in Zaire, and I recognized the critical understanding about large system change that I had been missing when I was there. At the age of 24, I just didn't understand. I learned that one has to approach a complex problem with a complex strategy, and that it takes timing and allies, many different allies, and patience to move mountains, not just good intentions. I want to return now to my meeting with Gilbert. I had initially found a PhD candidate to take this on this project for me. I was just going to supervise and sort of steer from a distance, you know. Well, that didn't work out. So here I was, sitting in a room with Gilbert, and all of a sudden, and this is true, all of a sudden, Chamoah's words from way back were suddenly whispering in my ear and took on a different meaning. An acknowledgement that cross-cultural work is hard and requires becoming personally involved, creating a biculture, if you will, a partnership that's real and that has integrity. Chamoah wasn't telling me that I couldn't make a difference. He was telling me I couldn't do it alone. And all the things I learned from Catherine Green and Sylvia Abney, a colleague at the university, and Azim, another colleague, congregant, and friend, whispered in my other ear. And the experience of spending time at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Edmonton in March of 2014 on behalf of the Canadian Unitarian Council washed over me. I've woken up from that sleepy fog now, and I've decided to become personally involved with this work, and I'm determined to get that pesky mosquito once and for all. I've made connections with the healthcare system, the Saskatoon Health Region, the Saskatchewan Cancer Agency. They are excited and willing to implement change. I built partnerships with Aboriginal elders because I know I can't do this alone. And that partnership has now resulted in the first 25 Aboriginal cancer patients who voluntarily want to come and be interviewed by me. That happened in 3 days. The Aboriginal elder that I'm working with is just in the process of putting this on her Facebook page that goes out to 2,500 people. I think I will soon be overwhelmed. My project manager is an Aboriginal nurse and researcher who on the drive to our first interview suddenly announced that she had the metaphor for our project. And she said, it's a Canada Goose Snow Goose Alliance. I said, what the heck? And she said, don't you know? The Canada goose and the snow goose, they fly together to get where they have to go, to make it easier. And then when they get there, the snow goose goes there and the Canada goose goes there. She said, I'm Aboriginal, you're white. We're doing this together. I'm aware this is going to take 5 or 10 years, maybe even more. That's okay. This is work that feeds my soul, that will make a difference, and that suits who I am at this particular point in my journey. I expect that my journey will make a difference to how my profession interacts with Aboriginal people to achieve the best care possible going forward. As is often true with journeys, it's hard to see the beginning or the end when you're in the middle. But I'm of the belief that each step along the way, going all the way back to Chamoah, was necessary and inform my ability to move forward in the journey today. I believe that community, for me, my church community, and my work community. Those are an important part of one's journey. What's your journey? What's your ministry? What feeds your soul? Who whispers in your ear? I invite you to think about your own life in terms of a journey, in terms of your ministry. Thank you.
Would you like your text back? We have a few minutes for questions, so I need the mic then. Are you going to take it around then, Jim? Thank you.
You talked about the pesky mosquito in your tent. We never had that problem when we were tenting, but after a long day, we were just crawling into our sleeping bags, and my friend was half asleep, and I went to get into mine. There was a huge toad or frog. I went to grab it, and it leaped onto her face, and she screamed. I grabbed it and tossed it out the tent flap. And the next morning, when I was telling our fellow travelers, they said, "What did you do that for? If you'd kissed it, it would have turned into a prince."
I'll try that metaphor next time.
I worked in Africa for a year also. Probably people here are tired of my going back to structural problems, but I'm very much aware that the IMF has vetoed any kind of health initiative in Africa that does not involve promoting some big hospital or something where the money is behind it. You know, the public health system is always vetoed by IMF. And I think unless we realize the structural difficulties we have in terms of our governments and the national, international scene, we're going to continue to be in serious trouble.
Can't disagree with you.
I am from Africa. And cows and cow dung plays a major role in village life. The cow dung is used as fuel, probably dried out in the field. It's used as fertilizer. It's also used to spread to for the floor, mixed with clay. I've never heard anything about the using the cow dung for cutting, drying of the umbilical cord. But my thinking is that that practice is probably centuries or even millennia old. And if it didn't work during the time that you were there, or that there was an epidemic of children dying from that application, my thinking was, what are the cows eating now?
It's a good point. As it turned out, this was just a very small collection of villages that were doing that, and it was not part of their traditional practice. So it was some women who had started doing that as a thing they thought would work. So that. And because it wasn't their traditional practice, it also was why we were able to change their mind around it. Right? But yeah, I like your thinking though. Like, so if something doesn't make intuitive sense to us, try and think a little deeper.
Thank you, Gary. And I was going to ask you, because you mentioned your partner being a pesky mosquito. Now, my question to you is, how are you dealing with it now that you know about the elders and remind me of your friend in Zaire, in the Republic of Congo? How do you deal?
How do I view Liz?
Yes, how do you deal with it now?
She's the most wonderful pesky mosquito in the whole world.
And I think we're going to have to cut that off here now because we're rather late and you're going to hang around for a few minutes, I think.
Yeah, we'll stick around for coffee if you're having coffee.
Okay, all righty.
Wasn't that great? Hey, just so interesting.